Radio Influence, podcasting redefined.
Hello, everyone. This is Saqib once again welcoming you to another episode of Tennis with an Accent. We took a hiatus last week, but we are back now. The show is produced by RadioInfluence.com. And today we are in conversation with Paul Timmons. You probably follow his very insightful tweets and tennis commentary. And he's a very reasonable voice when it comes to all tours, ATP, ITF, and even the Challenger Tour. So let's not waste much on the introduction and bring the guest right in. Hey, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. No problem at all. No, it's thanks for inviting me.
No, it's really, I think you're going to add a different dimension to our conversation here, because your in-depth analysis on the ITF tour is something I think a lot of people are talking about. That's a topic that's getting a lot of momentum on tennis Twitter, and some of our common friends have called you a purist. So just for our audience and the listeners, there's no one watching, but why don't you talk about your blogging and what your interests are? I know you're heavy on the ATP side, so just walk us through what you've been covering as far as the tennis tours go.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 30 now, and I was a sort of a late developer into tennis. I didn't really start on really being very interested until I was about sort of 20 when I was at university, and it's ever since then my love for the sport has grown tremendously. Obviously I started out at the ATP level, was as we all would, watching the slams, but I've over time grown to really love and enjoy sort of all elements and aspects of tennis, right down to what we call the futures tour, the very bottom rung. And it's As I've got to understand the sport over the years and really get a better understanding of how it all works, it's become apparent, particularly since the ITF decided last year to make sweeping and really quite drastic changes to the Futures Tour, that this was going to have an impact on tennis as a whole moving forward. So it was at the back end of last year that I decided, after sort of looking into that, to start writing a blog. And that's kind of really my focus now, the Futures Tour and the sort of the Challenger Tour side of things, just to give people who may not necessarily follow it too closely a chance to get a viewpoint from someone who's a fan of the sport. And I have no axe to grind. I'm just here to give my views and on how I see things moving forward.
Okay. Hey, Paul, your voice is clear, but there's some disturbance. So are you walking? Because whenever, I think what I'm trying to say is there's some background.
No, sorry, I'm sitting still.
Okay. All right. Okay, so let's continue. Paul, before we get into, the crux of the issue, which is the ITF transition tour right now, for someone who's blogging about these transition tours, what are the sources you rely on? What are you following for matches? And where's the data coming from? I know it's in this day and age, it's not, it's not difficult to get access to anything, but just for someone else who might be interested in following these tours, if you can just, enlighten us. What are some of the avenues that you rely on when you blog about the ITF and even the Challenger Tour?
Yeah, so with regards to the Futures Tour, you actually do have live streams of some tournaments now. And so if you go onto itftennis.com and look on their live score section, if you click on that, it'll, you can have an app and you can actually watch some matches now at that level. But the itftennis.com site does give you a lot of information about the transition tour. So I tend to sort of use that as the official source. And Twitter itself is a great avenue for talking and discussing with different people. So there are pros on there that talk about their lives. There also are, some good tennis websites. You guys do some good work, and there's a few others that I use, but I would say a lot of it is the ITF main website that I'm predominantly using to get my facts, and then I'm sort of building my case around that.
Okay, that's good. So yeah, let's talk about the ITF transition tour. You recently blogged about it, and many people have been talking about some of the changes that have been put forth this year for how the tour is going to be, and it's going to be a seamless transition for the juniors. And if you've read Paul's blog, there's some very interesting information. So, Paul, what do you think has gone right if we just look at the few positives? I know it's still early days, and then we can get into, what is ambitious and what may not go right and what the picture doesn't, capture what's going on in the tour.
Yeah, I mean, one positive you could certainly argue is that any junior currently inside the top 100 rankings is eligible for a junior exempt, as they call it. So that gives them direct access to a main draw of a $15,000 tournament. Straight away they're into the main draw. And I know I'm going to get his name wrong and apologise, but there's the Ukrainian Eric Van Schelbaum, who won a tournament earlier on this year using his junior exempt. So the idea is, to move juniors along at a quicker pace, and you could therefore argue it's been a success for him on that basis. That's the only positive that you could potentially argue for the new system at this stage.
So how many players are playing actively roughly on the ITF Junior Tour? Because this is the first stepping stone for juniors, right? What tournaments are included in this? Are junior, action at the majors, is that part of it, or that's still independent? Just tell us more about foundation of this tour.
It would be sort of the junior majors make up the rank, part of the rankings. There's a number of tournaments in the US, the Eddie Herr Orange Bowl. These are the big junior tournaments that they will be playing throughout the year. And they go all towards making up the junior ranking. But of course, again, as we know, the very top juniors often move away from the junior tour at a young age anyway. Your Alex Zverevs, Denis Shapovalov, many of these guys are already playing on the pro tour anyway at that age. My point and my concern is that the argument being made is that juniors aren't given the chance to progress into the senior tour. And I just fundamentally disagree with that. I can't think of any examples, and I haven't had anyone give me an example of a junior who has not had an opportunity to progress to a senior. If they haven't, it's because they just simply haven't been good enough, I've found. So I fundamentally disagree with the ITF in terms of why they think this is a good idea.
And what kind of backing, say an American player, gets from the federation? Because on the main tour you hear about America, of course, the powerhouse in tennis, has a major, has quite a few main tournaments on both ATP and WTA, so a lot of wild cards and a lot of opportunities for local juniors are there. But at the foundation level, which is the ITF, how much does that come into play? Like, if you're from America or Australia or some of those big tennis nations, is it a level playing field? That's what I'm trying to ask.
No, absolutely not. It's going to get worse under this new system. That's without a doubt the biggest issue. In order to progress now, you need plenty of money. When we're talking about players from these major nations, they're going to be getting the support that they need through their federations, without a doubt. The UK, Australia, France, United States, these countries are capable of providing opportunities to these players through wild cards and funding and things like that. It's the guys from the smaller nations that are going to see their opportunities heavily reduced, I feel. I feel like I need to just quickly explain. Effectively, what we've got now is a system where If you're a top 100 junior, you'll be given a chance to play in these $15,000 events. You need to be playing in them, winning matches and earning ranking points as part of this ITF system in order to move forward. If you're one of those guys from the bigger nations, you will have opportunities to be given wild cards into the $25,000 events or perhaps even challengers. So you will have your opportunity. But if you're someone from a smaller nation in which they just don't host challenger events, for example, you are going to have to be winning and winning early. Because if you leave the junior setup and you're no longer getting the junior exempt into main draws, and you're now 19 years of age, where do you go from here? Because there are just the opportunities are just going to cease up. You unless you have the ranking points early, that's it for you. It really has become that sort of situation. It's frightening, absolutely frightening. And I've seen on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot plenty of 19-year-olds and whatnot that are just looking for opportunities now, and they're not there. It's a crying shame.
And I think the other dimension to this is what you rightfully said is the bigger federation, of course, you know, have a lot to dictate. And then the other big gateway that gets these players in is big academies, either the IMG or even the Patrick Martoglu Academy. Because when my podcast was kicking in, I was just, you know, like many bloggers and podcasts, I was, you know, pinging players on Facebook and Twitter. And I came into touch with Stefano Tsitsipas. And then he got me in touch with his agent who was working for, you know, London-based firm. And then after, you know, back and forth an email and a couple of phone calls, I was able to secure a podcast interview with Tsitsipas. But that time he was, you know, I think his claim to fame was just he was a junior Wimbledon finalist, if I'm not mistaken. But how many juniors have that kind of a threshold when they're managed at 18 or 19? I'm sure, you know, this is a business and we've seen the likes of Safin come through the system and there are so many examples. But these are still, I have to believe that these are still a handful of examples where a Tsitsipas or a Casper Ruud is managed, you know, and gets in early looks. And of course, they both have cashed in, and Stefano's a top 10 player or top 15 player now. But what's your research tell you about, you know, these academies and these agency having, you know, some sort of a gateway for these players to, you know, make the successful transition?
Well, certainly there's, there is the case, you know, in terms of, say, Stefanos, he's a Greek tennis player who, you know, again, if you look at Greece in terms of what it offers in ATP events, it's marginal. There's nothing. So for him, he's had to be the elite at the junior level to have the interest from an agency. And, you know, let's be honest, an agency's in it to make money. So by being involved with him, you know, he's an investment for them, and that's why they're keen on him. But if you're someone ranked who's not quite the elite junior, and you're Greek, who's to say that an agency or an academy is necessarily going to be interested in you? And that's the problem. It's becoming about the elite, and that's it. And that's not what tennis is. There are many, many examples of players later on in their lives achieving, you know. I mean, even if you look at, I believe he may be about to win shortly, Marco Cecinato. Where did he come from? He was, you know, in his early 20s and has flown up the rankings and, you know, reached the Roland Garros semifinals, winning titles. That's who tennis is also about. It's not just the elite. And that's the worry with this new system, is that if you haven't got an academy or a big agency or a big federation behind you, you're going to struggle.
Yeah, so I'll encourage everyone who's listening to, you know, go in and read, you know, your wonderful blog where you have gathered some interesting facts, and I'll dig in some of those facts right now, dig into. You said there are 350 players who do break even financially. So now are you including the ATP top 100 as well, or is this category only applicable to the lower ranked players from the ITF and the Challenger Tour?
No, I mean, 350 is still a debatable figure in any case, but that would include that certainly the ATP top 100. So I wouldn't go any further than that for players breaking even. That would be the absolute maximum, I would suggest.
So what is, besides, you know, you have to be like a top junior, as we discussed, or coming from a big federation, or you have to do a lot of winning to get looks into these, you know, this kind of a pathway to the Pro Tour. What are the financial difficulties, you know, that come with the tour, even if someone who's actively getting in and probably losing 6 weeks in a row without winning a match? So where is the money coming from, and what are some of the difficulties, you know, for a pro to make a living, you know, at this stage and not get discouraged, because, you know, very few make it to the top 100.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to go back to it, actually, with regards to juniors and stuff, I wrote a blog on the success of junior major winners. And I looked at every player since Roger Federer won in 1998 up until 2013. And just shy of 30%. So these junior major winners, remember, just shy of 30% of those had not even cracked the top 100. So that shows the depth of tennis and senior level. And in terms of, you know, sort of going back to your question about cost, it's astronomical. You almost have to accept that you are going to be losing money before you can really ever hope to achieve. And I can't think of that many sports where you have to have that kind of attitude, where you accept you are going to be in quite a bit, you know, a substantial amount of debt in order to really get on the rung before you can begin to win. That's the case at these futures levels, and it's difficult stuff for these people. And the ITF are now turning away thousands of players and removing thousands of players' opportunities. So we're going to see a drastic drop in the number of people playing at that level, for certain.
Have you spoken to anyone, or have you read enough why this decision, you know, is making sense to them? Is there a shortage of funds, or what is the mindset? Because, you know, it's kind of misleading. They say it's going to create more opportunities, but it looks like what your data and your analysis has compiled, it's pretty much pointing in the other direction, that, you know, more and more players won't get the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, what they're claiming and what's actually occurring are two completely separate things. You know, their statements are nothing short of a myth. In terms of, if you look at the raw data, there's a reduction in tournaments, there's a reduction in the number of opportunities, and it's having a drastic knock-on effect. You know, I know players that I've spoken to who are already ranked. You know, this is the thing. The recommendation was for 750 pros on the men's and the women's side. Well, there's players ranked currently 600 in the world. So within the criteria that they're setting, that cannot find a tournament to play. They're alternates on lists to get into tournaments around the world. So, you know, their justification has been that there are too many professionals not making enough money. And I can actually agree with that. I do think there are too many players that simply cannot perform at that level and become profitable. That's fine. But what they've done is they've cut the number of opportunities overnight almost. There's been no phasing in of this project, and it's affecting people hugely. It's killing people's dreams. And finally, I think that the biggest one that they're claiming is related to gambling. There's no doubt in my mind that it is an epidemic at that level. Corruption and match fixing, sadly. That's not just my personal opinion, that's an opinion of an independent report that was done that recommended at the $15,000 level that the live scoring was turned off, that the data the ITF sell was no longer used. And I think the ITF are hiding behind their new changes and claiming that somehow this is going to address that gambling issue, that match fixing issue, and it's not. It's clear as day. They've solved the data, and that's the problem. So,
I was going to say it's a shame, and that itself is a conversation by itself. But again, yeah. That scenario is probably the byproduct of. Again, I'm no expert, but you think, just in any walk of life, these kind of desperate measures, are kicked into more full gear when, there are desperate times and people are not getting opportunities or there's not enough money on the, out there to be made. But again, this can be a full blown conversation, and we can probably have a panel later on to talk about this. But on building on what you just said, so just tell our listeners the transition from the ITF to the ATP Challenger Tours, and is there still possible for a player to have his ranking points carry to the Challenger Tour, or that's totally abolished now?
Yeah, so it's two completely separate ranking systems now. So effectively, if you're starting from scratch, you would have to work your way up the ITF rankings. So the ITF have $15,000 and $25,000 events, but you would only be eligible to play the $15,000 initially. So you need to work your way up the rankings. There's only a few spots available at the $25,000 events for people with an ITF ranking. And it's at that point that you probably want to be around top 50 in the ITF rankings, ideally. That will give you the opportunity to play these $25,000 events. And then also the challengers. The challengers do have a total of 7 spots. I'll get onto the challengers in a minute, but they have 7 spots available for ITF ranking players. And at that point, it's then you have the opportunity to earn ATP points. But what I would suggest and would warn is that if you're an ITF ranked player playing ATP events at the challenger level, you need to be winning and winning quickly, because as we know with the ATP rankings, if you are not winning matches and your points come off and you fall down the rankings, well, that will happen with your ITF ranking. So it's there are so many players stuck in limbo between the two, desperately trying to make the transition across, and it's become significantly harder.
So basically the top 50 or the top 100 ranked juniors from the ITF can come into the Challenger Tour, but they cannot carry forward any ranking points. And on the second sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry. If you're a top 50 or a top 100 junior, you are only eligible for a main draw spot in a $15,000 tournament.
On the ITF.
The ITF level. If you see a top junior playing a challenger event, that's because they will have been given a wild card in terms of an opportunity. But being a top.
Okay, so that's what I was trying to ask was, and then the top ITF ranked players get into the ATP Challenger Tour, so that's the door they walk through, and then there they can earn points enough, and then if they win enough, just like anything else, they can crack the main tour, which is pretty much like the top 100.
Yeah, it's just become much more difficult as a result. There's no doubt that the players at the challenge level have it. If you're already a challenger level player now, it's a lot easier to maintain that status because of this new change. Yeah. There's no doubt about that. That's something you can ask any pro. That's the case.
I mean, on a very relative note, I remember last year, I think Gulbis was in Vienna and then he had to fly to Dubai. He got in the main draw. And then he said in some interview, I think, to one of the reporters who was covering, that he had to pay almost like a last minute ticket, $4,000. And the Gulbis comes from money, but then if that's what pro tennis is, and you go there and lose first round, then plus the hotel costs, and if you have a coach traveling with you, so that's a very serious problem. If you look at, like you said, this is the only sport where a majority of players are not making money. It's a job. like you're a private consultant, but your expenses, you know, outweigh what you earn as a majority. If you look at you know, the big picture.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's I spoke to a player a couple of days ago. I discussed the costs of being in Sharm El Sheikh. I believe we were discussing about for a futures event, and when we sort of added up the cost, the flights, the hotels, everything else, for a 2 week stay, that it would have cost them roughly sort of £1,000, you know, British pounds. That's for a 2 week stay at the futures level. Even if they win both weeks, they're pretty much breaking even at that point. You know, so it's that's, you know, that's, you're talking about someone who has to win tournament to be breaking even. So tennis has a real issue with prize money at the lowest levels, and unfortunately, like you say, there's a reason that people fall into the trap of match fixing and the like because of that. It's frightening.
Yeah, and then you see, you know, like stories like Paolo Lorenzi, like late bloomers, you know, players who made their mark in their early 30s. And, you know, we all talk about how great a story it is, but sometimes we don't fully appreciate the journey behind it. Years of playing at the Challenger Tour and just not having enough ranking points and enough, you know, consistency in form and results. And then once they make the tour, you know, they are, you know, the talk of the town for some time. But a lot of time, the whole aspect of the journey, I'm not saying is lost, but is not fully appreciated.
Well, especially in today's game, where you see the average age of the top 10, even the top sort of 100 has increased quite dramatically over the last few years. You know, players are looking after their bodies better, and you know, the sports science has improved massively. So people are developing at a later age. So that's the problem with this change, is that it ignores the fact that people are late bloomers, and consequently, you may see players dropping out because of that. It's almost become a case of, you need to be a top junior, you need to prove that you've got something by the age of 18, otherwise you're gone. And yes, like you say, you've got Lorenzi, but also the guy that I think of always is Victor Schüller Burgos. Made the top 100, I think, at the age of 34, and then proceeded to win ATP Quito, which obviously no longer exists. But he wouldn't be around with these changes. I guarantee that.
So again, let's talk about, you know, what could be the solution here, because, you know, in the last year and a half, with all the rivalry between the ITF and ATP, now they're going to have their own team cups, and those are all, you know, well known facts, and how, you know, there's such a divide between the tennis governing bodies. But then looks like it's the players who are impacted here, and there's lesser opportunity than earlier. So you think ATP should have more of a say? What is the ideal state, like, where a player is winning but also his or her points are also carrying forward? Because that points are also very synonymous how you're going to get looks into some draws if you're not coming from a big academy or a big federation. So what gives in here, and what do you propose as someone who's close to this? What is the ideal fix in this kind of a scenario?
That's a really, really good question, and I'm going to be honest, I don't fully have the answer. I think we have to remember that this was something that the ITF said took, I think, about 3 years worth of investigating, and for them to come up with this system. And it was only really foisted upon people, I think, in November of last year. So I've only had a few months myself to look at it. So I don't have all the answers at this stage in terms of what can be done. But I think you do make a valid point. I don't think that the ATP and the ITF and their seeming internal struggle that they're having for power is helping the players at all. There's reports that the ATP demanded the ITF stop selling live data for scoring. And if they didn't, they wouldn't provide points. This has been Dirk Hordoff, who's the vice president of the German Tennis Federation, made that claim, to which the ITF have denied it. but I don't think that we know the full story about the power struggle that's going on and the effect that it's having on the tour as a whole. So until we start getting some honesty and some answers on that, it's hard to know how to move forward. I definitely think when you see the ATP World Cup that's coming this January, which is in effect a real direct challenge to the Davis Cup, it's clear that the two sides are in a real bit of a power struggle. And like you say, it's the players that are certainly lower down that are being affected. So until we get some real answers, it's hard to know how to move forward on this issue.
All right, so I think this is a conversation that's going to keep unfolding, and we can stay in touch and talk about it. So let's talk about the main tour, because that's also always intriguing for the conversation here, and especially the listeners look forward to some of the input. And since I have you here, let's talk about Gael Monfils. I mean, this guy is one of the biggest what if stories in tennis. So much talent, so much athletic ability. There's a lot of opinions, polarizes, a lot of conversations, but today, or actually not today, this year, winning in Doha and now playing a very physical tournament, especially in his last two matches against Medvedev and Stan Wawrinka, and coming out victorious. Shot selection has been his undoing. Let's talk about this man. What did you see? And does this bode well? Does this set up some sort of a platform? Because the French live and die for Roland Garros, and of course it has been Rafa Nadal territory. But let's talk Monfils now. What do you see, and what should we expect?
It's incredible the last 2 weeks that he's had. Obviously, he got to the semi-final last in Sofia, and then winning this week. I didn't see it coming this week, as I said. I thought Daniil Medvedev would deal with him yesterday, and I thought Wawrinka would today. Like you say, he infuriates people, because I think they see someone who has so much natural talent, athletic ability, and it's almost it does feel like he's underachieved. But at the same time, he brings so much joy to the court that people can't help but root for him. What does it mean for him moving forward? I don't know. That's always been the case with Monfils. He gives you a feeling that something big is around the corner, and then flatters to deceive. But the last 2 weeks, certainly, he's been very, very impressive, without a doubt.
And he's played this guy, Daniil Medvedev, yesterday in a very, very physical match. And this is, again, just going by, the cliches, Zverev is well established, but Tsitsipas and Khachanov, some of these other guys are getting, a lot more attention. Medvedev is not totally lost in the attention scale, but he's someone whose graph has been steadily, rising. And top 10 is within his reach. Doesn't have many points to defend from now until clay. And I don't think clay is his best surface. So this is definitely a guy, I think, who's destined for top 10, in my opinion. What's your take, and how impressed are you on what you have seen, including the match against Novak in Melbourne?
Yeah, I mean, he gave Novak his toughest match at Melbourne, without a doubt. His development towards the back end of last year was incredible, particularly on the indoor run at the back end of last year. I've seen it mentioned a few times by different people, and I agree. He's very much a sort of a Gilles Simon in his style, almost. But he's 6'6" with a good serve as well. I checked his clay record, and he went 1-5 last year. Winning only the one match. So it will be very intriguing to see how he does on the surface this year. As you say, because he's got no points to defend, I certainly see him being a top 10 player in the future. And, if you look, he's beaten Stefanos a number of times already. He's got an immense amount of talent, and it's only a matter of time before he's an established top 10 player, I feel.
Do you see Russia as a powerhouse tennis nation as far as the new format of Davis Cup with him in the mix and Rublev, who's kind of fallen a little behind, and then there's Karen Khachanov? What do you think of that that threesome?
Yeah, I think there's that's exciting for Russian tennis. I think certainly Rublev has fallen off quite drastically, unfortunately. He's someone I do enjoy watching, but Khachanov and Medvedev are two very exciting young players. I mean, you could therefore argue they're the two strongest from any nation, really, at this stage, quite potentially. Yeah, I would be very, very excited if I was a Russian tennis fan for the future.
All right, so these are like more of the Q&A type of conversation, but talk to our listeners about some of the other names that you think, you know, are worth mentioning when you're here on the podcast, and who's on your radar, some of the young players, and who's making some sort of a comeback. I want to listen, and I'm sure anyone who's tuning in would also want to know.
Yeah, I mean, if we go a little bit further down the rankings, I'm a huge fan of Matteo Berrettini. I believe he's moved into the top 50 now. I think he's number 47. He is a big man with a big game, and he took Stefan to four sets in Melbourne, only losing in a fourth set tiebreaker. He's capable of playing on any surface, so I would highly recommend keeping an eye out for him this year. I think he's a potential top 32, you know, seeded player at a slam for next year. He's certainly someone who interests me. And then you've got in today's New York final, Riley Opelka. I mean, he's an absolute giant of a man with a gigantic serve, and he's, only 21 years old. He has got a big, big future ahead of him. I'm not a huge fan of the big servers, but you can't ignore what he can do, and he's going to have a big future.
Talking about Opelka and the 250 New York Open, that's going to conclude today as well. Let's talk about this tournament. I know this replaced the Memphis Open, which was on the calendar for quite some time. And New York being, you know, the Big Apple center of a lot of sports, and, you know, tennis is, you know, one of the four majors. The initial response, or at least maybe that's why they brought it here during the winter in Long Island, was, you know, it's going to boast a lucrative field. But going by the first two editions, looks like, I don't know what the contract is. I see this tournament struggling to stay there. What's your take on this, and how do you see this place in the calendar, particularly when the main action is in Europe right now for indoor season?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. It's a European-based part of the year, quite frankly. You've got Marseille, then Rotterdam and Montpellier. They should sort of, you know, you swing. Sorry, Montpellier's first, but that's where all the focus and attention is, and I wouldn't want to almost be running a tournament in New York at the moment, because it's a 250 in the week of a 500 event. You're swimming against the tide, and you only have to see the crowds or the lack of crowds to appreciate that. It almost looks like it's an event running on borrowed time, because I just don't see where they're making money from, unfortunately.
That's a tough spot, but I remember, like, when I was following tennis when I was in India, through mostly newspapers, and there was a tournament, I think, in the springtime or in winter in Philadelphia, that used to be a Philadelphia indoors, and the likes of Lendl, McEnroe and Sampras, you know, played some of those finals. So some of it is also like the top men are not American. So I guess that's been the biggest undoing, because there was an event in San Jose not too long ago when Roddick was playing. So there was some representation. Now with John Isner and, you know, some of these other guys coming up like TFO and I don't know if Taylor Fritz was in this field, but some of it is also marginalized because, you know, the power of the star power has shifted more towards Europe and even some of the countries like Argentina, and US has a good lot of players, but it's not the best players. So I think that also has to weigh in when these decisions are made, because they'll never get at a 250, forget getting Djokovic or Federer or some of those guys, but they'll never even get like a Dominic Thiem or a Sasha Zverev to come, you know, from Europe to play this 250 here.
No, certainly not. I mean, in the same week as well, you've got a clay court event in Argentina currently. So, and I think it's a very valid point you mentioned about the lack of real, real top Americans. That's what an American crowd wants to see. They want to see American tennis players ultimately, and there's just not enough of them at that highest level. So, I think as well the weather in New York this week has been dreadful from what I understand. So it's just everything's going against the organizers there right now, and it's a shame because you want tennis to be thriving no matter where it is, but I think they're really going to struggle moving forwards.
Yeah, I think well said. It's just an odd spot in the calendar, and unless they have star power to back it up, I don't see a promising future for this event. But again, I've been wrong many times on this very podcast, so I wish the tournament to do well, but it's looking it's not looking too promising.
Not for sure.
So anyway, Paul, I think we covered quite a few interesting topics here, and I think this should be a good listening account for anyone who will listen to this podcast. And once again, thanks for doing this. I know Sunday is a hard day because you are writing about tennis and it's probably your day off, but I just would like to thank you on behalf of myself and Matt, and hopefully we can have you for future conversations regarding more irrelevant topics as Tennis with an Accent continues to grow. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Sakib, and best of luck to you guys at Tennis Accent. You're doing some really, really good work, and I'll continue to try and drive people towards you guys.
Okay. Thanks for the kind words.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so I got like close to 41 minutes, which is decent. This is what we shoot for usually. Our podcasts are 40 minutes or more, so I think we covered quite a few topics here. And then the only thing is I'll send this for sound test for the company that produces the podcast. And in case they think the sound is because the phone is not good, will you be up to record this again? I mean, I hope there's no problem, but if it is, I'll let you know. I don't know what your bandwidth is for tomorrow night or something.
That's fine. If there's an issue with the sound, I'm going to get myself some new headphones, and I'll happily re-record it with you. Not a problem.
Yeah, it's just a background. I think rest of it is pretty clear. I think you didn't drop the level, or the sound didn't drop at all. It's just, I guess, there's some background noise because you don't have a headphone on, which is fine. So, and if all goes well, then this will be released early morning Tuesday in. US Eastern time, so that'll be late afternoon for you in UK.
Okay, lovely. Yeah, just let me know about the sound. It's not a problem if you need to do it again or whatever, but yeah, no, it was good to talk.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
If you listen to this podcast and that I've been doing for the last year and a half, I said way back when Colin Kaepernick is going to win. I mean, because collusion is a real thing. If I had a team, do I want Colin Kaepernick on my team? I'm not sure. But you still can't argue that he doesn't deserve to be on a team skill-wise. The NFL lost the case. It was settled. And the rumors are that Kaepernick got between $60 and $80 million. That's winning. That's winning. And then I heard people say, well, that's not a win. The NFL makes so much money, they don't care. Billionaires don't give up nothing. They don't give up $5, more or less, $80 million. And if you give somebody $80 million, that's admitting I was good and wrong, okay? Doesn't matter what side you on, if you make 32 billionaires give you millions of dollars, they were wrong because they don't do that. They don't give nothing to nobody. They were wrong. So Colin Kaepernick's winning. I mean, Colin Kaepernick was named Man of the Year. Colin Kaepernick's got a settlement for somewhere close to $80 million to not play football? Shit. If you say, Ian, I'm going to give you $80 million in next year, you can either play football or not play football. I won't move. I'm not playing football. Sorry. If I could not play football and make $80 million, I win. Colin Kaepernick is winning.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.